An hour or so later, a knock at the entrance to the guard's van heralded the king's secretary, who this time smiled strangely and said, "The king would like to grant you an audience, Mr. Litvig." And he smiled again and said, "And that, I'm sure you're aware, means at once." The king was sitting at a little table doing paperwork when Moist arrived, and beckoned him towards another chair in the carriage, saying, "Mr. Litvig, I understand that following our visit to Mr. Simnel's mother, you appear to be under the impression that I may be hiding something. Is that the case, Boyle?" The king looked at Moist with a stern glare, almost as if daring him to utter what he was thinking. "Well, she does have a lot of feminine insight." Moist let the rest of the sentence tail away and watched carefully. The king sighed and looked at Aaron, who was standing on guard by the door. Rhys nodded and then turned back to Moist. "Mr. Litvig, I'm sure you are aware that the sex of dwarfs is often a well-kept secret, and there have been times when even to inquire about the sex of another dwarf was considered a terrible thing. I am the low king of the dwarfs, but if I can get to what I might call the bottom line, I'm also female." And there it was. This was the thing that had been niggling at the back of his mind ever since Mrs. Simnel had started making the sleeping king, queen now, he reminded himself, comfortable back in Stolat. He coughed and said, "Well, nobody's perfect, Your Majesty, and to tell you the truth, I think I've known for some time. I'm good at putting rumours, suspicions, and instinct together and getting the right result, because I'm a scoundrel. I expect Lord Vetinari has warned you about me. You could say that I'm Lord Vetinari's scoundrel, as if he needs one. Scoundrels take a different look at people, just to get the measure of them, the way they walk, the way they talk, the way they sit. All the little details left unsaid in the wrong place." The Queen was silent for a moment and said, "A real scoundrel. Yes, m'lady. I would say one of the best, possibly the best," said Moist. "But these days you might say that I'm tamed and at heel, which means I'm a very trustworthy scoundrel." "At Vetinari's heel, you poor boy." And now the Queen looked as if something worrying had been chased away, and she said, "You must know, Mr. Litvig, there are only very few people who are aware of my secret, and they are trusted. One of them is Lady Margolotta, and another, of course, is Lord Vetinari. It has always seemed to me that the attitude of dwarfs when it comes to gender is curdling us. Dwarfs, we keep insisting, must be seen to be male. And what does it say about a species if they can't look their own mothers in the face? We live a stupid lie and play a stupid game, and I don't want this state of affairs to continue. I am indeed the low queen, Mr. Litvig, and I thank you for your silence at this time." The Queen appeared as innocent as one of those mountains which year after year do nothing very much but smoke a little, and then one day end up causing a whole civilization to become an art installation. "Mrs. Simnel is a nice lady," she continued, "although perhaps not as discreet as she thought. Of course, I know I can depend on you to treat my secret as if it were your own. I'm sure Lord Vetinari would be upset if you didn't do so." Moist polished his best reassuring smile to sparkling. "As I told you, ma'am, I'm a born scoundrel, so I've learned to be very, very discreet for the sake of keeping my own neck safe from people who take a dim view of scoundrelhood. And as for Mrs. Simnel, she knew all about the secret of steam and never told anyone about it." The Queen stroked her beard and said, "For a proud mother, that must have been testing indeed. Very well, Mr. Scoundrel, I will have faith in you. And now I can see that Aaron is becoming restive, so I'd better return to my paperwork." She sent what Moist would swear was a teasing glance in her secretary's direction. Moist, for whom it was second nature to watch and listen carefully, most particularly to what was not said, now felt he knew another secret, a secret as yet unacknowledged. The Queen and her secretary were, without doubt, lovers. Possibly you had to be married to notice this fact, but their body language shone through. A meaning cough from Aaron recalled his attention. The secretary was holding the door open for him in a clear signal that the audience was over. As Moist stepped out past him, Aaron said, "Thank you, Mr. Litvig, from both of us." Before he set off back to the guard's van, Moist stood for a while, letting the revelations settle. The king, being a queen, was looming in his mind. Oh, yes, Everybody knew that dwarf women looked very much like dwarf men, beards and all, even Cheery Littlebottom. An Ankh-Morpork dwarf, if ever there was one, and a strict feminist, although she was adamant that beyond the beards, dwarf females were not the same as dwarf men. And since she was now very big, as it were, in the watch, her insistence on chainmail skirts and subtly altered breastplates didn't matter too much. But the Queen? What would happen if the Queen declared it? It would be Aliar Yaktar Est in spades, and there would be no going back from that. Aaron had now disappeared back into the Queen's armoured coach, and Moist was left listening to the rattling of the train. The future, he thought, was going to be incredibly interesting. The everlasting fog that filled the vertiginous gorge created deep swirling shadows in the fading light as they approached the final bridge before the Wilderness Pass. And the fog itself seemed to be alive as it moved and twisted, leaving the watchers with the feeling that they were teetering at the edge of the world. The far side of the bridge was barely visible as Simnel stood in earnest conversation with the head engineer in charge of the bridge works. A bit of darkness in the fog near Moist turned out to be Commander Vimes, grinning. "A rickety bridge, a heavy train, a terrifying drop to certain death below, with a pressing deadline and no backup plan," said Vimes. "You must be in your element, Mr. Litvig. I'm told the engineers say it can't be done. Are you really planning to risk the Low King and the future peace of this region on one throw of the dice?" Behind them, an engineer said, "I wouldn't travel over that for a pension." As Rhys and Aaron joined them, the creaks and groans of the ancient bridge structure intensified and seemed almost alive, like some demon daring them to chance their fate. The less fanciful of the engineers might talk of natural movement caused by the drop in temperature as night approached, but it was hard to ignore the ominous atmosphere of the place, which was almost eldritch. Then Iron Girder snorted steam, panting like a dog ready to be unleashed. Moist took a deep breath, stuck his fingers into his jacket, and smiled with a confidence which had blossomed just a second before when he had finally heard the subtle sound he had been waiting for. "It's a little-known fact, my friends, that these fogs have remarkable solidity. Allow me to demonstrate." He stepped off the edge of the cliff beside the track and stood there with the fog swirling around his ankles. He heard gasps from behind. He turned and faced his fellow travellers with a huge grin and a silent sigh of relief before stepping back onto what might be called solid ground. "You see? Would you like me to run to the other side and back again while this mystical phenomenon continues, as I believe it will, or shall we all go over now while the time is ripe?" "Do you mind if I try?" said Vimes. There was a twinkle, and Moist said, "By all means, Commander." And Vimes disappeared into the swirling fog, lighting his cigar, saying, "Just like standing on a pavement. Amazing. I suggest you make steam, Mr. Simnel. I'm in some doubt about how long such a, as you say, mystical phenomenon will last. So I think alacrity is our motto here, gentlemen." Simnel, resisting the natural temptation of a scientist to examine the phenomenon more closely, looked around and said, "Oh, aye, all aboard, everybody." And after a moment he added, "Quickly, please." Moist looked at Simnel and said, "Do you now believe, Dick?"
"Yes, Mr. Litvig."
"But do you really believe?"
"I surely do, Mr. Litvig. I believe in the sliding rule, the cosine and the tangent, and even when the quadratics give me jip, yes, I still believe. Iron Girder is my machine. I built her, every last rivet carefully forged by hand. And I reckon if I could bolt rails onto the sky, Iron Girder would take us to moon."
Moist whistled and heard a signal from below. He raised his voice and said, "Forward, please, Mr. Simnel." And immediately there was the familiar chugging sound of a train anxious to be travelling and getting up steam. Moist loved the moment as the power built up slowly and by degrees until there was a rolling thunder taking charge of the universe and they were moving into the villainous fog and onto the bridge. It was difficult to see anything from the footplate, but Moist could just make out Simnel's white face as the vibrations and swaying intensified. Despite Moist's dramatic demonstration earlier, he could tell that Simnel and his crew were terrified, and even he began to doubt whether the bridge would in fact hold under the pressure. And then the vibrations suddenly ceased, and there was a strange sensation as Iron Girder left the rails and she flew. Down below, the fog curled into even stranger shapes, spiralling vortices, stirred up by the passage of the train,
and after a strangled few minutes there was a thump of wheels on rails as Iron Girder consented to exchange flight for the sensible permanent way once more, and then Dick blew the whistle and kept blowing, and she was bowling along again as if nothing uncanny, mystic, or even eldritch had happened. It wasn't until Moist found time to himself, after all the backslapping he had received, that the enormity of what he had done hit him like a jackhammer. A whole train under steam, full of passengers, and a king apparently flying through thin air. And he sweated again as the next thought said, so many things could have gone wrong. In fact, so many things could have gone wrong, and he began to feel certain that history might just slam backwards to ensure that they did. And the sweat ran down his whole body, but he wouldn't have been Moist if he couldn't recover from this sort of thing, just as long as Vetinari never got to hear about it. The thought of Vetinari was still proving hard to banish later that evening when Moist finally bunked down in the guard's van. As the motion of the train lulled him into a tired and relieved doze, an image of the patrician swam into Moist's mind. He shuddered at the recollection of his recent encounter. Vetinari had been at his desk reading reports of what looked suspiciously to Moist like other people's clax messages. Although this accusation has never been levelled by anybody's his lordship, which is to say, none have been found. He had frowned when he saw Moist and said, "Well now, Mr. Lipwig, is the train already cleared for Überwald by any chance?" Moist had assumed an expression that would not have deceived a child, which was, of course, part of the game. "Not quite yet, my lord, but I think the prospects are getting rosier by the hour." "Long-winded. Very long-winded indeed. Come to the point, if such a thing exists, please. After all, I do have matters of state to deal with." "Well, sir, I'm sure you recall we have buried within the city limits a number of very ancient golems, and you vowed that they would only be deployed in the event of a threat to national security. And right now I think I could use several dozen of them, sir. That is, of course, if you don't mind."
"Mr. Lipwig, you surely try my patience. I'm quite well aware that both you and your wife have the tools that would allow you to enter said vault and indeed give said golems instructions. But nevertheless, I strictly forbid you to try anything of the sort. This has to do with the railway, I'm assuming."
"Yes, my lord. A little minor problem on the train to success, as it were."
"Let me make myself entirely clear. If I find any evidence that you have removed city golems from their proper place and, moreover, have taken them outside the city limits, you will be thrown to the kittens. Is that understood?"
Vetinari's expression was flat and impenetrable and as placid as a sea of pitch. And Moist had bowed and said, "I assure you, sir, no such evidence will ever be found." While overhead, the words, "if I find," floated like a sly invitation. Uncomfortably alert again, with Vetinari's voice echoing in his head, Moist drew out the clax flimsy he'd had from Adora Bell about the progress of the golems. He tore it up and threw the pieces out of the nearest window, from where he watched them disappear in the wake of the wonderful train. From the gloom of the guard's van behind him, someone coughed pointedly. Vimes emerged with a little smile and said, "Plausible deniability, eh, Mr. Lipwig? But well done, anyway. Just between ourselves, those golems that'll never be used, what do you suppose they're doing right now?" Moist opened his mouth to deny all knowledge of the golems, then thought better of it. Something in Vimes' eyes dared him to try. "Digging their way back home, I trust," he said. "Rather more easily, since they tunnelled their way up here in the first place." And in the distance behind the train, the rickety bridge was falling bit by bit into the valley, in a curious kind of mechanical ballet. It would be some time before it could be used again, thought Moist. But now we've got Rhys this far, we can throw everything into getting this damn bridge built properly. And a few hours later, as the golems tunnelled under his tavern, the Großzügig Stein, Herr Mückenfuss noticed the floor dancing and every glass and stein in the building shook rapidly. Plump though he was, he scooped up every falling stein and glass with great determination until there was a sudden settling in the air and the tavern was eerily silent. He looked at Herr Bummel, his solitary customer, who stared at the dregs and Hischstein of the new cask of old Blanc they had been sampling before whispering in impressed tones, "I think I'll have the same again."
As Bjonk came ever closer and the horizon was now eaten by the mountains, looming outlines visible against the night sky, steep slopes occasionally catching the moonlight, Commander Vimes called a council of war in the guards van, the centre of operations. With the experience of the attacks at the Paps and the destruction of the flyer to draw upon, careful plans were laid for the defence of the train and the king. "Well, now, look around, all of you. What you see is canyons and trees. If I was a Grag, I'd probably see this next stretch as my last available opportunity to derail Iron Girder."
Vimes's face was grim as he outlined his proposals, and Rhys nodded his approval, interrupting now and then to add a refinement. "We must also take care of attacks from above," the commander continued. "As we've seen, Iron Girder is well protected. She has her corsets on now, thanks to Dick's new alloy, but we might have to fight on top of the carriages. I see you grin, Mr. Lipvig. So, smart boy, if that happens, I invite you to join me and the others on the roof when the time comes. Are you game, sir? It's likely to be very dangerous up there." The inner moist patted himself on the back as he thought of his illicit adventure on top of the flyer. He could dance on the train, jump and spin and twirl, because he had the measure of the moods of every part of the train.
"I've wanted to do something like this ever since I saw my first locomotive, Commander," said Moist. "Yes," said Vimes, "that's what I'm afraid of. So I must tell you that we work as a team or we become separate corpses." He pointed at the trees towering overhead and the deep cutting they were travelling through. "There is very little space in this damned cutting. Trees, nothing but stiff weeds, remember that." "I'm sure we could do it," said Moist. "Why not bring Detritus up top as well?"
"No, he's good on the ground, but he isn't limber. Anyway, with Detritus on top of it, I'm afraid the roof would pretty soon become the floor."
The commander looked around and said, "The rest of you know your stations. Remember, we're on this train to get the king back again. Guard him. Don't bother about us on top."
When he could speak to Vimes with nobody else listening, Moist said, "I know the rhythm of the train, but I'm no fighter, Commander. Why choose me?"
"Because, Mr. Lipvig, you'd pay a king's ransom in order to say that you fought on the roof of a train. I've seen you. You're a bastard in close combat, worse than Nobby, and he tends to bite their knees. I saw the corpses of the Grags in an incident at the Quirm Railhead. You can fight, if only in terror, but it's true that the coward can often be the best fighter of all."
As the sky grew pallid in the pre-dawn, the atmosphere on the train changed. The whole crew knew that they were now heading at top speed right into unfriendly territory. On every crag in the mountains of Uberwald, you could see the lights of the Igors twinkling and wobbling in the darkness of the canyons, and green lightning flashed from gargoyle to gargoyle like spectres. Moist had generally always kept away from the place. You got the occasional werewolf or zombie in Ankh Morpork, of course, but in Uberwald they were commonplace. This was their place, with their rules, and that included the Black Ribboners, the slightly weird types who had sworn to shun the temptation to drink people's blood, and similar. But they were still weird, possibly even more so, drinking only cocoa and marching with banners and drums on every possible occasion. Arguably, that was better than being taken to the crossroads and staked, again. The hand of Lady Margolotta was visible everywhere, and Moist knew that where you found her hand, you would also find the hand of Vetinari. But now there was menace in the air. Although Moist was, in fact, okay with menace, it was the thought of dying that was uppermost in his mind. And his little internal demon was shouting, "Ha ha ha ha, remember that a life without danger is a life not worth living." And valiantly he stood by that assertion, though quite frankly he would rather have been standing on a beach in Quirm, if possible eating one of those really nice ice creams they made, with a wafer-thin cone that crunched so beautifully as you bit into it, with strawberry sauce and sprinkles. Moist stood in the middle of the guard's van, letting his body understand the motions of the train. He rocked when it rolled and concentrated on staying upright. After all, he reasoned, if there was going to be a fight, then your legs had to know what was waiting for them. Vimes was puzzled about what he was doing, but when Moist tried to explain, the commander snorted in derision. "In general, Mr. Lipvig, I try to disable those who are trying to do the same to me as quickly as I can. It's a simple little approach, not very complicated, but it helps me stay alive. That and the understanding that almost everything has a groin and every foot has a boot." The sound of metal and stone bouncing off the carriages came as a relief, like an expected shoe dropping. The train was travelling through a cutting that had once been used by wagons, and Irongerda almost touched the rocky sides as she passed through at less than half speed. The guards' van was in a state of siege, and only later did Moist learn that Grags had swung down from the sides of the cutting. An unfortunate few dwarfs had landed on Blue John's flatbed, and while the biggest officer of the City Watch was at heart a pussycat, two Grags trying to hack lumps out of him was clearly causing him to become somewhat acerbic, and so the pussycat was now fighting like a lion. He hurled curses in Trollish, which actually shone red in the air as they were cast. Quelling his nerves, Moist grabbed a Jim Crow and opened the trapdoor onto the roof of the guards' van, to the initial amazement of the Grag who had been trying to force his way in. But any sense of achievement the dwarf might have felt was knocked away by the vicious metal bar hitting his jaw with a satisfactory clang. Moist wasn't surprised to hear Commander Vimes scrambling up after him, and now, surrounded by Grags in a state of disarray, Vimes tore off his shirt, and as other dwarfs approached him, Moist saw them suddenly realise that their futures were in the hands of the legendary Blackboard Monitor. Once freed, the brilliant scar on the commander's wrist was almost throbbing in the half-light. The Grags stared at it, and that was the first of their many mistakes, because the commander went, as they say in Ankh Morpork, totally librarian on them. As Vimes charged towards the far end of the van, he smacked away one distraught Grag so that he landed on top of another, making it look almost balletic as they twisted and fell onto the rails below. And now the goblins joined in to make the Grag's day just a little bit more interesting. Goblins in your armour was definitely not an aid to fighting. The trapdoor and an adjoining panel had been torn away from the top of the guard's van, and while battling a particularly ferocious dwarf, the way that Moist fought was erratic, since he took the view that if you didn't know what you were going to do next, neither would the enemy. After all, it was a melee, and nobody owns a melee. You might as well try to control a hurricane. Moist saw Detritus levelling his enormous crossbow through the hole and heard the troll shout, "Peacemaker!" a signal to anyone of sense to take extreme cover immediately. The darts that the peacemaker fired were hardwood and therefore horribly dangerous. And if Detritus was really feeling fit, the weapon spat the wood so fast that the darts ignited as they flew. Not metal, only wood, but wood going so incredibly fast that it splintered into 1,000 more darts, all travelling at terrible speed. When the thunder had died away, Detritus yelled up to him, "Hey, Mr. Lipvig, this van is going backwards. The grit suckers knew just where to take the engine off." Moist turned and saw, to his horror, Irongerda pulling away at speed from the now-stranded guards' van. He looked down at Blue John, who was holding a Grag in each hand, and there was screaming as he banged their heads together and tossed them into the darkness between the tracks. "We're going backwards, Blue John!" yelled Moist. "Take us forward, could you?" There was a jerk as Blue John stopped the guards' van dead, quite possibly with his feet, and Moist jumped down onto the shuddering flatbed. "Nice work, Mr. Blue John. Now get out that thing Mr. Simnel's lads made for you, please." In his curiously childish voice, Blue John said, "Oh yes, Mr. Lipwig, I can do that, and I can tow the guard's van as well." Vimes dropped down from the roof, where he had been making life difficult for the Grags on top, who were now essentially on the bottom, shouting, "What the hell's going on? Why have we stopped, and where's the rest of the train?" "Those buggers have uncoupled us," yelled Moist. "But it's no problem. There's a handcar on Blue John's flatbed, for emergencies." And indeed, when the pedals of the handcar started to turn, the guard's van accelerated and shot like an arrow towards the disappearing Irongerda. Blue John's big face was aglow as he paddled like, well, Blue John, because nobody else could have made that flatbed fly along the rails. It rattled and screeched and complained, but the troll's huge feet oscillated up and down in a blur, and the inner demon of Moist von Lipwig whispered to himself, "A little treadle machine to help somebody travel fast. Might be an idea to remember that." The whistle of Irongerda echoed around the canyons, and Vimes shouted, "Get me up close to that train, officer!" Trolls don't sweat as such. A kind of blooming takes place instead. Blue John grunted, "Getting a bit out of puff now, Commander, but I'll do my best." Blue John's handcar, still dragging the guards' van, including the recumbent Grags, slammed into the last carriage, and before it bounced away again, he reached forward and grabbed a buffer in each hand. Immediately, Vimes flew like a demon, running across Blue John's ample back and into the besieged carriage. Moist followed as best he could. Grags and Delvers were everywhere, still trying to get into the armoured carriage ahead, and then it was just a matter of who was friend and who was foe, and there were far fewer friends, making it very easy to spot the foes. "Come on, lads! No speeches, you sons of mothers!" Vimes shouted back to the others in the guards' van. "You know who the enemy is, and you know what to do. Get them before they get you, and don't let them get anywhere near the king. I made it up on the roof." Up on the swaying roof of the armoured carriage, Vimes quickly started to take his toll on the enemy, who were swinging down from the canyon walls onto the moving train. Unhappily for the attacking dwarfs, the problem with swinging down was that the defender on the train could easily judge where you were going to land, which was precisely the place you then got hit mightily with a Jim Crow. While Moist and Vimes, well accustomed to the motion of the train, could keep their feet, the dwarfs, even with their low centre of gravity, simply couldn't fight on the rocking and rolling carriages, and the two men were able to knock them down like skittles. Moist couldn't help feeling sorry for them. Idiots with a cause, and it had been such a stupid cause to begin with. And as he was watching Vimes fend off an attack from two of the buggers, there came a blow out of the darkness that knocked Moist onto his back, taking the wind out of him. He looked up into the face of madness. That special kind of madness warped by idealism. The madness that gloats, which in these circumstances was a bad idea. The Grag swung his axe, but with reactions born out of terror, Moist managed to roll as the mighty blade struck the roof beside him, splintering the wood where his head had just been. The Grag lifted the axe once again, and Moist thought, well, this is it then. A life without danger is a life not worth living. Maybe the next one will be even better. And then he saw it and grinned. The entrance to the tunnel. And so he winked, as only Moist von Lipwig could wink, and said, "Goodbye." Sparks rained down, and it took him a moment to realise what had happened, or indeed, what, unfortunately, had not happened. The tunnel was just too capacious. The Grag had not been shortened as expected, and his axe was scraping along the roof, making a rather impressive fountain of sparks in its wake, illuminating the scene just enough for Moist to kick up and find his target, hoping against hope that this dwarf wasn't a female. And fortunately, luck was with him, and therefore regrettably not with the Grag, who dropped his axe, clutched at his groin, and unceremoniously fell from the carriage onto the tracks below. As the train emerged from the tunnel, it came to a grinding stop. Moist scrambled to his feet and clambered back down across the flatbed to find out what had happened to the rest of the gang. He was relieved to discover the crew of the guards' van all more or less unharmed, including Of the Twilight, the Darkness and his group of goblins, Fred Colon, Nobby Nobs, Cheery Littlebottom, Detritus and Blue John, who was still hanging on to the last carriage, keeping the train together. There were also a few rather bewildered engineers and train drivers, some of whom had been trying to catch up with their sleep when the attack came, but who had apparently done their best. Moist hadn't noticed Nobby and Colon in the melee, but decided that he would not be surprised to hear that they had acquitted themselves with great derring-do, and of course it was such a pity that it would turn out everyone else had been too busy to see them doing it. Even so, looking around the few groaning Grags still on the train, Moist acknowledged that Nobby and Colon, if given no alternative, could fight like tigers, especially tigers with the nasty weaponry of the streets, where anything went, and wherever it went, it could be very, very painful. Colon, in particular, was master of the underhand, and some of the groaning was familiar to Moist as the famous Ankh-Morpork lullaby. Moist never thought of himself as a leader of men, so he delegated in circumstances such as these. The chore of marshalling went to Fred Colon, known to all for his excellent shouty voice that turned his face an unusual shade of puce and was expelled at a volume that even Iron Girder would have envied. Such grags as were alive, or weren't definitely dead, were trussed up before being taken to the guards' van, where, Moist suspected, Commander Vimes would have a little talk with them about this and that, and names and places, and who and when, and what dreadful manners they had. Lovely. And now a figure leaned out of the armoured carriage. It was Aaron. "The king is safe! Thank you all! Iron Girder came in for a hammering, but the grags that managed to get onto the footplate were shown the furnace by Stoker Blake." Moist winced at that. He had been close to the furnace a great many times when it had been opened by the stoker, and it was instant suntan time, but if you were standing in the wrong place at the critical moment, it was instant fiery death. The journey onward, with the couplings once more in place, was altogether a sombre ride, for the victors as well as for the surviving dwarfs, awaiting their dreaded conversation with the blackboard monitor, who, it was believed, could cause you and your family never to have existed, rubbed away, as it were, in the chalk dust of the blackboard. A little later, Iron Girder gently kissed the buffers at the Bionk railhead, and the first person to step down onto the hastily erected platform was Rhys Reeson. He was greeted by a very large and extremely agitated rotund man who had the word Burgomaster stamped firmly into his demeanour. He was sweating cobs, and a fat man can sweat just as much as an engine. He genuflected to the king, an achievement considering his shape, which was, not to put too fine a point on it, a globe.
"Welcome back, sire," he said, panting. "The humans of Bionk have always had a good relationship with your countrymen, and I sincerely hope that this amicable arrangement is going to continue."
This invitation was uttered at very high speed, and Moist saw it for what it was, a plea saying, "Please don't hurt us, we are fairly decent people, and have always accepted your Highness's claim to the Scone of Stone." The unsaid codicil being, "Please don't hurt us, and above all, don't interfere with the running of our mercantile activities, please. Please?" Rhys gripped the proffered and rather sweaty hand and said, "I'm so sorry if you have been inconvenienced by the recent unpleasantness, Humphrey," a gesture which left the Burgomaster all smiles.
"Oh, it wasn't too bad, Your Majesty. It was a bit of a nuisance when you, I mean, the others started knocking down the clacks and all that. But you know how it is. It's like a family squabble in the house next door, where you know it's not your business, so you're ready with tea, sympathy, and possibly bandages and medicaments. And next time you meet the couple next door, you don't look too hard and mind your business and are still friends on the morrow. And anyway, her ladyship got involved, and once she'd made a couple of examples, well, thank goodness we had our clacks back. She's firm but fair, is Lady Margolotta, and remarkably swift."
The sweating Humphrey knew full well he was talking about the most influential vampire in the world, whilst at the same time giving her the appearance of an elderly lady who only had to bang her walking stick on the floor to get total respect.
"Of course, all families have their ups and downs," Humphrey continued. "Those little spats so easily started and so quickly left behind with no real damage done."
Behind the Burgomaster, the train was unloading its passengers, while Iron Girder occasionally hissed or spat, in the way a locomotive has, making it clear it is not entirely quiescent. Moist could hear Vimes debriefing Captain Sally von Humperding, the watch's only vampire member, who had been seconded to the Bionk watch. They came over to report.
"Sally tells me that even though all communication from within Schmalzberg has been cut off, reports have been reaching the watch that all is not well with the conspirators," said Vimes.
He looked to Sally for confirmation.
"Yes," she said. "Our sources indicate that the Grag known as Ardent—"
She was interrupted by a snort of rage from Rhys and a rattle of axes from his assembled compatriots.
"Him again," snarled Rhys.
"Yes," said Sally, "him and a few others we've been trying to locate after the massacre in Quirrem. Well, it seems that Ardent and his followers are losing support. They're not having it all their way. There is unrest."
"Good," said Rhys. "We can use that." "An Albrechtsen?" asked Aaron.
"Well," Sally smiled,
showing a hint of fang, this being the most appropriate place in the world to let them get some air.
"Well, and loyal to you, sire."
A rather smart goblin messenger insinuated his way through the crowd and passed a message to Sally, who read it.
"Ah," she said, "it's a message from Albrechtsen. It seems the opposition know you've arrived, sire. Albrechtsen would like you to know that he's being well treated, and has been able to follow the progress of Iron Girder thanks to the goblins."
Rhys turned and looked at Simnel and Moist and said, "Thank you and Sir Harry for getting me here safely, and Iron Girder too. At the appropriate time, you will know my generosity, and I'd like to talk to you further, but do excuse me, I have a kingdom to reclaim." Addressing the company of dwarfs now fully assembled on the platform and armed to the teeth, he proclaimed,
"Let it be known that the Low King has arrived and will take his place on the Scone of Stone. Anyone wishing to deny him that trivial pleasure should be prepared to back up their coherent and well-founded objections with weaponry. It really is quite as simple as that. This message will be carried into Schmalzberg by Bashful Bashfulson, a highly respected and knowledgeable dwarf known to all, accompanied by my trusted secretary Aaron.
We should also include Commander Vimes, the Blackboard Monitor, and one-time ambassador to see fair play. Remember that at all times, tampering with the King's messengers is a matter of treason. Be aware, I'm not going to be a nanny about this. Insurgent dwarfs will get their just deserts.
The sound of Vimes loudly lighting his cigar broke the silence.
Let the others go first. I'll go along in a minute or two, he said.
Moist, of course, hadn't been at Combe Valley, but right now he wondered if he was about to see the ghost of Combe Valley's second incarnation. Except it would be dwarf against dwarf. He wanted to shout out, "This is nuts!" and realised that, in fact, he had said it aloud. To his surprise, the king said,
"Certainly so, Mr. Lipvig. It beggars all reason, doesn't it? But sooner or later there comes a time when you have to take names and crack skulls. I'm sorry, it's at the other end of the spectrum from the little chat, and it's what happens when reason no longer holds sway."
"But you're all dwarfs. What can you possibly achieve?" groaned Moist, who for the rest of his life would always remember the tone of the king's voice.
"Tomorrow. That, Mr. Lipvig, is what we can achieve. Tomorrow."
The arrival of the messengers sent an immediate buzz around the multiple caverns of Schmalzberg, somehow the centre of the galaxy when it came to hubbub of all sizes and rumour mills that turned faster than the mills of the gods. Rumour flowed like quicksilver. The phenomenon might be called the dwarf clacks, were it not for the fact that the clacks didn't scramble the messages on a whim, thought Moist as he followed Rhys and the main band of dwarfs down into the honeycomb that was Schmalzberg. The myriad noises flowing up from below through every tunnel and cavern were merging into a kind of audible mist, or, he thought, fog. It simmered around the earlobe, the terrible sounds and confusions of war. But now individual sounds were getting through, raised voices, screams, and the clatter of weaponry, punctuated with the occasional yell and dwarfish curses, which are known to have a life all of their very own. Further down, they came across Aaron, who was waiting with blood dripping from his sword. He noticed Moist's look and shrugged.
"There was a Grag. He fought hard but would not submit, preferring death to ignominy, and so I accommodated him."
That last phrase contained more emphasis than Moist had heard for a very long time. Aaron turned to Rhys and reported.
"There have been certain clashes of opinion, Your Majesty," he said, pointing to several dwarfs being treated in what would have been an impromptu field hospital had it been in a field.
Swords, hammers and axes were being deployed below as the king carried on marching until they came to what must be the Great Hall, the largest cavern of them all. As they passed through the portal, Moist came to a halt, trying to get a grip on this subterranean landscape lit by the enormous chandeliers of dribbling candles, along with cressets and great vats of squirming verms. Verms are somewhat like glowworms, but with a stink that illumines. They can be found in deep, dark places, where they subsist on the effluvia of any creatures that may arrive there. They are very useful to tomb raiders and others of that kidney, who in turn are often very useful to the verms, especially their kidneys. Squirming verms writhing in the corners. So there was light, he thought, but a strange light that was somehow negotiating with the eyes. You could see, but what you saw was the darkness.
"Well, it's not a war any more," said Vimes, suddenly there beside him, "and not too many serious outcomes, except for the Grags. That's dwarf-on-dwarf war. A hell of a lot of shouting and accusing and spitting. A lot like cats, really, but that's dwarfs for you. They're not that stupid. Bags of bravado and sabre-rattling, but no one really wants to get hurt. You fight hoping for a small wound that looks good afterwards. Something to show the grandchildren. But really, when it comes to it, dwarf against dwarf, it generally settles down."
Vimes puffed his cigar and continued.
"Mind you, if it were dwarf against troll, this place would be running with blood. On the whole, it's like the taverns of Ankh-Morpork on a Saturday night. Everyone is full of gumption and pissy bravery and beer. Much too much beer. And then afterwards, it's just a lot of groaning until they see the light."
In fact, what Moist could see nearby was dwarfs in small groups, some of them bandaged, in positions which suggested that war as such, if not over, had been set aside for a breather and maybe a decent quaff. And younger dwarfs were going between the hurt and wounded with flagons. And one by one, the dwarfs got up, shook hands with the nearest dwarf and walked haphazardly to the next group, where perhaps they would sit and chat and make up stories of near misses and clever parries and similar boozy boastings. Little by little, dwarf normality was flowing through Schmalzberg once again.
"Pester's farts," said Vimes. "But at the bottom, not bad. Just susceptible to rabble-rousers." He sighed again. "Maybe this time they'll have learned. And on that day, Nobby Nobbs will be a shining hero."
And that was all it took, Moist found himself wondering. After all the adrenaline of the train journey, the ambushes, the attacks, the bridge, the sleepless nights, expecting at every turn to hear the swish of a scythe and to find that this time his luck really had run out. And then Rhys gave a fine speech and just walked in and took back the kingdom. "I was expecting them to put up more of a fight," he said. "You know, more of a glorious battle that would become the stuff of legends."
"That's a very foolish thing to say, Mr. Lipvig," said Vimes. "There's nothing glorious about times like this. People have died, not necessarily good people and not too many, but nevertheless, the face you wear on a battlefield should be a solemn one until the time when things are cleaned up and the real world drips its way in."
Moist felt the shame welling up from his boots and said, "Commander, I stand abashed quite sincerely." And instantly, Vimes's face was eyeballing his, and the commander exclaimed,
"Really? It seems it's not just the railway breaking new ground here."
For once, short of a ready reply, Moist turned to see what had become of Rhys and his party. Rhys Reeson had entered the cavern at a run. He headed straight for its centre, where stood the scone of stone. Now he looked around and demanded, "Where is Ardent? I want him brought here, and as many of his followers as still remain, though doubtless most have run. This place is full of exits."
Bashful Bashfulson shouted, "I have the scoundrel here, sire."
The assembly of dwarfs went into the usual seemingly endless dwarfish hubbub, followed by a deep intake of breath from all concerned when Ardent was brought forward. His expression Moist couldn't read, but Moist, the man for atmospheres, could tell that Ardent was already somewhere beyond sanity, whilst Rhys seemed as cool and calm as ever, however fearful he might have been on the inside. And Moist would have wagered the mint that the king wasn't actually fearful at all. There was something in his demeanour that suggested an absolute assurance that this day was his, or indeed hers, as he finally allowed the thought to creep back into his consciousness. Sitting on the hallowed scone of stone, with Ardent in front of him, Rhys said, "You were dealt with mercifully after the Combe Valley Accord, and still you thought it was right to try to take this kingdom from me. You encouraged those who tortured families to get their own way. What would people think of me if I had even a most minute inclination to treat you kindly? You are clever, and many dwarfs speak highly of you, but your cleverness has been used to undermine my rule and make dwarfs appear to be vicious and stupid criminals in the eyes of all other species. What have you to say in front of me and your kin?"
Ardent was silent.
"Very well," said the king. "No answer. You leave me no alternative. In times gone by, a dwarf king would execute someone like you as a matter of course." And then there was the sound of metal, and the king stood up, axe in hand. At last, the light of terror passed across Ardent's face. The king said, "Oh, I see. Then perhaps, as I am, you know, a moderniser, as you always say with a sneer, perhaps I'll deal with you as a moderniser should. Therefore, you will go on trial, and I shall see to it that among the jury there will be the families of those the Greggs tortured, and those surviving guests of the wedding in Clamedos, and all the others whose lives have been unnecessarily troubled by your existence in this world. They may be merciful, and I will accept their verdict."
Ardent remained silent, and the king said, "Take him away in chains, but keep him alive, if only as a reminder for me that being a king is not an easy job."